Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second installment of Latin American Review Headlines. This is our live stream. We're just going to let our followers on Twitter know. There we go. And we are with, live from Sao Paulo, Brazil, with Camila Escalante and our good friend, Brian Mier. So how's it going, Camila? I think last time you were in Sao Paulo, it was pretty cold. How's it looking now?
It's beautiful. The weather has been about 34 degrees. It's sunny today. People are out rallying. They're doing some final campaigning across Sao Paulo and the entire country, trying to get people excited to vote on Sunday, try to evade any voter abstention and get people hyped up. We're 2 days away from the big day. And so Brian's going to tell us a little bit about that. I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction. Brian has actually lived in Brazil for decades. He's been here since the 90s, and he is currently the correspondent reporter for Telestor English. He's also an editor at Brazil Wire, a really important English language outlet that has for years reported on Brazil and has often been one of the only sources bring truth to light about what's been going on here, particularly the coup against Dilma, the lawfare waged against Lula da Silva, among other things. And he's also a personality on Brazil 247, which is a really important outlet here in Brazil. Of course, it's in Portuguese. It's for a Brazilian audience, which makes it different from his other outlets and the other coverage he does. But he does some really great live streaming on YouTube there on Brazil 247. And so, Brian, thank you so much for being with us today. So we just actually left a rally that we'll be going back to. But Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about what is going on with the final campaigning and a little bit about the housing movements that we were just out with?
Okay, well, it's for several years now, it's been the opinion of the big labor unions, mainly the CUT, Labor Union Federation, which is the second largest inter-syndical organization in the Americas after the AFL-CIO, and the famous working class social movements of Brazil, like the MST, and the urban movements like Centro de Movimentos Populares, MNLM, etc., that just getting huge amounts of people onto the street isn't enough to really influence things. Because of the way it's framed by the media, you can put 50, 60,000 people on the street, and they'll say that it's, they'll report in the media that it was 4,000. They'll send a TV crew there at the beginning of the protest when it's empty and say that was what it looked like at the height of the protest. And so they adapt a wide variety of techniques. And one of the tactics they've been using in this election season is the creation of hundreds of agitation and propaganda brigades. These are cells of 100 to 200 working class or poor urban social movement members who go out to different parts of different cities and have like small media spectacles for the social media and canvas and hand out pamphlets and things like that and march to one place or another, uploading it all onto the social media the whole time. And they found this is a different kind of tactic. And it's all done to bring out the vote for the Workers' Party candidates, right? Lula and whoever the local candidate is. They found that this is an interesting way to not base the entire activism just off of these big mega protests. So in Sao Paulo, across Brazil, there's about 40,000 members of agitation and propaganda brigades. Here in Sao Paulo, there's about 7 brigades, and today's the last day they're going to be active before the election, because tomorrow everybody's going downtown to Paulista Avenue to parade down the street with Lula and Haddad, the gubernatorial candidate, and Geraldo Alckmin, the vice presidential candidate. And that would be one of these things where there'll probably be 100,000 people on the street, it's just interesting to see, and they're active in all 26 states. In some states, in some cities, they might shut down a road with burning tires during rush hour. You know, here in Sao Paulo, they've been a little bit more, not as radical. They've basically just been like shutting down a street physically by marching down it, but not using the tires or anything like that. And it looks like it's a way to dialogue on a smaller scale with passersby who might be supporting Bolsonaro at the moment, but they might be a little bit confused because of all of the like pedophile allegations against Bolsonaro and all this other crazy scandals that are happening right now. And it's one of the reasons why a little bit of momentum is picking up for Lula, even though Bolsonaro has outspent him by around 300 times by harnessing the budget of the federal government to reroute funding into different measures that benefit the middle class mainly.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to say to everyone watching, if you want to put questions to Brian or Camilla, you can do so in the live chat. I'm here watching it. And although Camilla and Brian are in Brazil, I'm in La Paz, in the central. So I'll be attentive to any messages in the live chat. So Brian and Camilla, I just wanted to ask a little bit about the polls, because obviously in the first round, they didn't get it quite right in terms of underestimating Bolsonaro's support a little bit. So what are the polls saying now, and how do you see it? And do you see them as like a trustworthy way to look at how the election could go, or is it, are we going to have the similar sorts of things?
Well, the polls have normally been relatively accurate. There's one polling agency, one of the major polling agencies predicted the result accurately, Atlas. And the other agencies predicted the amount of votes that Lula would receive within the margin of error. You know, no one was ever saying it's guaranteed that he would win in the first round. They were saying there was a 95% chance that he would get between 48 and 52% of the vote. He ended up with like 48.4, which wasn't enough to win in the first round. But they were accurate in predicting his vote. His vote hasn't reduced at all. It's in fact, it looks like it's picked up some momentum. And the polls, Atlas polling agency, which correctly predicted the first round outcome, is saying Lula's up by almost 6%. Some of the older and more respectable polling agencies, who we feel are being very conservative now because of their error in the first round, are saying 8%, 7% victory by Lula. The Bolsonaros are trying to suppress vote in poor neighborhoods because they know that the vast majority of the poor support Lula. In fact, in the first round, they voted 2-1 for Lula over Bolsonaro. So they're doing things like offering free vacations in some poor neighborhoods on the day of, you know, free beach outing or something on the day of the election. There's a big amusement park that is offering free admission on Sunday that's popular with working class people in the backcountry of Sao Paulo. And they're trying to intimidate people. There have been over 1,000 cases of employers ordering their staff to vote for Bolsonaro. They're doing another thing that happened in the first round is that a fake viralizing WhatsApp announcement was sent out to millions of senior citizens telling them that if they didn't vote, they'd lose their retirement benefits, right? And in fact, some of them were saying if they didn't vote for Bolsonaro, they'd lose their retirement benefits. And so even though turnout dropped a little bit from 2018, it actually increased among senior citizens. And they believe that Bolsonaro might have picked up 1 million extra votes from this measure, but they're not going to be able to get away with it again, because the Superior Electoral Court is really clamping down on this disinformation right now.
Yeah, definitely. And what about like the media? I mean, Camilla, you must have been, you know, you're there as press. You must interact a little bit with some of the other reporters. But how's the sort of the balance of the media coverage in Brazil? Like, I understand it's not the same as, say, for example, the elections that we had in 2020 in Bolivia, where the whole of the media establishment was going one way, because there is a certain section of the sort of liberal middle class that is not in favor of Bolsonaro. So how has that media coverage been and the balance of forces there?
Do you
want to
talk?
Oh,
so,
yeah. Well, you can take over, but I'll just say that, you know, Bolsonaro and some of his candidates and supporters have actually claimed that the media is now biased against him. And that's because, you know, we live in Latin America, and Brazil is just like most other countries, where we're so accustomed to the full weight of the media and the mainstream press being completely on the side of the right wing and the most neoliberal candidates, and in some cases, fascist candidates. And so, you know, that's what people are used to. People are used to getting all the airtime to be able to air their, all of the platforms necessary to be able to air their views, which are, you know, obviously in line with Washington, obviously very, in the case of Brazil, anti-communist, anti-socialist, against the social movements, spreading conspiracy theories even. And now things have actually, in some form, I would say, balanced out a little bit. Not to say that the media is doing any huge favors for Lula's campaign or his candidates. On the contrary, I would still say that it's, you know, a little bit bizarre to have watched some of the debates we've seen, for example. There's a debate taking place tonight on Globo. But, you know, in the previous debates before the first round, we saw six candidates, you know, get equal airtime, even though some of those candidates didn't even factor in the end, in the election. And they were given that platform to be able to speak, you know, against Lula, you know, to try to make suggestions that Lula and the former PT governments were corrupt. There's been a lot of accusations in the media from those anchors about corruption and about the charges against Lula, even though all of those were ultimately dropped. And so, you know, that signifies that we continue to be in that information war that's very much pinned against Lula, who in the end was proven to be innocent and had not done any of the things that he was accused of, but we continue to be bombarded by those lies.
It's true. And I'll just add that, like, most of the mainstream media in Brazil really came of age during the military dictatorship and has always been very pro-United States and pro, you know, Chicago school style liberal economics. But for now, there's a saying in Portuguese which goes, you can raise a crow, but it will still pluck your eyes out. And so even though these big media conglomerates like Globo, which is one of the largest media groups in the world, spent decades performing daily character assassination against the PT, the monster that they helped create, Bolsonaro, turned on them. And, you know, now they're worried of losing their government advertising funding and things like that. So they're going after Bolsonaro. But all of their praise, not just Globo, but all the other major media outlets, all of their attempted praise of Lula is always tempered with, like, but he better do this. But he better have a neoliberal economics minister. Why isn't Lula announcing who his economics minister is going to be? This kind of stuff, you know. So what they're pushing for is either the most moderate version of Lula that you could imagine, something that would be more in tune economically with his vice president, Geraldo Alckmin, or they're going to start immediately undermining his presidency from the first day he takes office, you know, with the hopes of destabilizing him so much that he's forced to make more and more compromises with the big right-wing parties in Congress.
Yeah, and what about the international media, the foreign correspondents? I'm sure, Brian, you've lived there for a while now, you'd be acquainted with them. But I don't know if Camille, you've bumped into some of them as well. Obviously, the people such as The Guardian's Tom Phillips, who has me blocked on Twitter, unfortunately. But how's the coverage been from these foreign correspondents in some of the sort of the biggest outlets internationally?
You want me to answer?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, in Tom Phillips' case, you know, he's been responsible for some of the... He wrote over 30 articles normalizing Bolsonaro between the first round and second round of the 2018 elections, you know. He even gave Bolsonaro headline space in The Guardian to compare himself to Winston Churchill and to say that it's the leftists who are the real fascists, you know, as if Churchill wasn't a fascist, you know. But it looks like someone up high has told Tom Phillips that he has to support Lula this month. And so Phillips actually, as much as I, you know, don't like his journalism at all, he actually kind of did a favor with this one article, because Bolsonaro's been campaigning that Lula is the favorite of all the drug lords, you know, the drug gangs and all of this. And Phillips, like, he has this kind of like violence fetish. He always tries to act cool by hanging out with, you know, criminals and things like that. And so he did an article about hanging out with some drug gang leaders in Rio. And in the article, they told them that they prefer Bolsonaro because he makes it easier for them to get guns. And so this was actually used in the Brazilian media a lot, and it had some positive repercussions in the campaign. Surprisingly, you know, when you look back at his history of, you know, smearing leftists all around Latin America, you know, I almost feel like he was ordered to write this thing, you know. So.
Yeah, and then I just wanted to add that, you know, we saw in the initial press conference for foreign media that was held with Lula, and you know, you saw The Guardian, for example, you saw CGTN, Reuters, Al Jazeera, Telesur was there. Oh, there were a whole lot of media outlets there. That was shortly after the campaign officially kicked off. But you know, they didn't get to all of the reporters. But what we did hear, the sort of questions that are being asked by these reporters, and you have to remember, it's not just the reporters individually who are going and asking these questions. The questions largely or often will come from above. They'll come from an editor, or they have to get those questions vetted. So these are very strategic, strategically placed questions. And there's only so much time there to answer those questions. And all the questions that we heard, I mean, people, again, from the foreign press were bringing up the issue of corruption. And they were saying things like, how is Lula going to ensure that, that you know, he shares power? Questions to that sort of tune, as if, you know, he doesn't have, as if the person who wins isn't going to have a very large mandate. This is a huge country. And we're talking about whoever wins is probably going to have at least 51% of the vote. That's what it's looking like in the polls, that he would have about 53% of valid votes. And so that's a very strong mandate. And still they're saying that, you know, they're questioning whether or not, you know, the legitimacy of a government that hasn't even been sworn in yet, and saying that he needs to, you know, share power, because of course he's being framed as some sort of a socialist that likes to cling on to power. That's why the national media has continued to make those associations between Lula and of course the governments of Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba, suggesting that those are not legitimate governments, or that they have held on to power for too long, that they're dictators and things of that sort. I think that the foreign media has been trying to make those suggestions as well. And they really are just, you know, scripting, you know, they're shaping their questions in such a way that they're not even questions, that they're making statements, you know, of which the, you know, they're not even questions that I find to be valid from the outset. And so, you know, that they have a very specific way that they're framing things from their headquarters, be it in London or New York or anywhere else. So that's been a huge disappointment. But there's also been, of course, in this election more than any other, more and more alternative outlets such as ourselves. And I think that people know that this is, you know, that we are one of the most reliable places to be getting this information. And that's why, you know, you see that interaction with our accounts and with our coverage when it comes to Election Day. And of course, the very important coverage of from Brian and from Brian's colleagues at his different outlets.
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead, Brian, go ahead.
I think that there's been this narrative brewing since 2018, which is just like, I've actually heard it personally from some Guardian correspondent who I won't mention the name of. But other, you know, I've seen it in the media as well. It's just like, well, Lula might win, but how can he govern? And you saw that in the reporting on the Senate and congressional elections. I mean, it was a disaster for the left. I mean, they'll never be able to govern if Lula's elected. It's, you know, Bolsonarismo is here to stay, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it was a false narrative because, first of all, when Lula took power in 2003, the Workers' Party had about 20% of Congress. It's never had more than 14 out of 81 senators. And it was a highly antagonistic environment. He was being attacked daily in the press, just like he's been for the last 40 years. that he managed to govern very well, you know. And the reason he did that was by making coalitions or issuing executive orders for some things. Like the entire affirmative action program, which is social class based, it doesn't benefit middle class Afro-Brazilians in any way. It's for anyone from the working class whose family makes under a certain level of money, with a differential for Afro-Brazilians that has transformed Brazil's free public university system from 2% Afro-Brazilian students in 2002 to like 53% right now. That was initially done with an executive order. It took the Workers' Party like 8 years to pass it in Congress and Senate after it had already been rolled out. So there's that way of governing, and there's also just making deals with these center-right parties who, you know, are just as corrupt as they've always been. They're just as corrupt now as they were the whole time. But if you want to govern, you have to deal with the cards that you're dealt with. You know, so I don't personally see the fact that the PT gained 21%. It increased by 21% in Congress and is now back to the same number of members of Congress it had during the Dilma Rousseff administration as a kind of loss for the left. Nor do I see the fact that they picked up another three senators as a negative. You know, they gained power in both the House and the Senate. And as always, Bolsonaro's coalition doesn't have a majority either. And whoever is elected on Sunday, hopefully Lula, all of these big center-right parties are just going to immediately cling to whoever takes power and start making deals with them. So he'll easily have over 50% majority on everything but the most radical measures that he wants to push through, which he'll have to do by executive order.
Yeah,
so the narrative is just BS in conclusion.
Cheers. So I wanted to read out a few of the messages we got. Reminder, if you want to ask a question to Bryant or Camilla, you can put it in the live chat and I'll put that question to them. We got some. T. Brown says, peace and greetings. Love Calcestri News. Appreciate Camilla's clarification on Lula. Cheers for that. Dennis Curry says, viva Calcestri News. Absolutely. And the lie that led to war 1951 says, greetings, comrades. Greetings to you too. So if you want to get a question in, just put it in there and we'll put it. And changing the subject a little bit, I wanted to know, obviously, we've got the World Cup in a few weeks. I'm very excited. But in Brazil, there is a certain politicization around football. And the big discussion has been around Neymar and his support for Bolsonaro. And really, I mean, it's something that's gone back quite a long time of Brazilian players backing the right, largely because of things like evangelical Christianity. I know, for example, that Brazil's goalkeeper, Alisson Becker, you know, I'm a big fan of. However, he has gone around, he's been baptizing, converting his teammates to evangelical Christianity, baptizing them in the pools at their own mansions. And so this sort of thing has been going on a lot. And so can it be reduced to that, to the issue of religion, for why, you know, a lot of senior players in the Brazilian national side have voiced their support for Bolsonaro rather than Lula?
Well, I think, first of all, Neymar's case is a little bit unique. First of all, Neymar is a lot more popular outside of Brazil than he is in Brazil. You know,
oh, really?
Brazilians don't watch that much European football. It's not normally shown on open-air TV or anything. I mean, people have started watching a lot more of it in the last 10 years since the Brazilian leagues have begun to kind of fall apart. You know, but as recently as 20 years ago, three or four best Brazilian teams were any season capable of beating any team in Europe. And they, you know, the 2002 World Cup team, for example, half the players almost were from Brazilian club teams. But when a player leaves for Europe, people normally stop paying attention to him that much, you know. And the main issue with Neymar is in Brazil, he just hasn't delivered. Like, he came after a generation of players who were known as, you know, who are awarded the FIFA prize as being the actual best in the world, like Ronaldinho Gaúcho, Ronaldo, Rivaldo, Romario, you know, even Kaká. And there was a lot of expectation that he would deliver a World Cup, and he hasn't. You know, so he's kind of all, I'm not saying he's forgotten about here, but you don't see a lot of advertising in Brazil with Neymar. you know, like you would do in Europe. He does a lot more advertising in Europe. But the specific issue with him is that his father has mismanaged his finances so badly that he owes 188 million reais in income tax. And he's, you know, at risk of like going to jail for tax fraud. And his father made a deal with Bolsonaro. Like, you support me, if you know, Neymar supports me, and I'll pull some strings and we'll make some arrangements. We'll write off that tax loss. And even Lula's pointed that out. Lula said, look, I have nothing against Neymar. I know the real reason he's saying he supports Bolsonaro. And as far as the other players, you know, unfortunately, evangelical Christianity is a problem, you know. There have been some legendary players who are leftists. The most recent, Juninho Pernambucano, he's, you know, still very solidly left-wing. Unfortunately, a lot of, I think a lot of players just haven't opened up that many books, and suddenly they're from poor backgrounds and suddenly got super rich, and they don't know that much about politics. Nobody's doing any politicizing with them, and many of them, as you point out, are members of churches that have grown farther and farther right over the last 20 years. And the reflection is this, that you see where you end up having a situation where, like, Liverpool has to give an order to its Brazilian players to stop posting pro-Bolsonaro stuff on their social media.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had a message as well from Robinho, who's been out of the picture for a long time. He's an absolutely brilliant player. I used to love watching him back in the day. But then he got arrested for rape in Italy. And he basically broke his silence to come out for an endorsement for Bolsonaro. I think now he's facing charges in Italy and could be extradited there to actually do prison time for rape. Like, was that something that was talked about a lot in Brazil? Like, did that hurt Bolsonaro's image, or people, you know, still remember his glory days?
Robinho's another guy who a lot of Brazilian people just felt he was a big disappointment. My personal take on Robinho is that Real Madrid ruined him. He was never a striker in Brazil. You know, he was a right offensive midfielder, like Garrincha, like number seven, like Cristiano Ronaldo. So he got on the team, Ronaldo was on there. So they said, let's make a striker out of him. He never had a strong shot, and it blew his confidence, you know, and so he became like a very good striker. Whereas in Brazil, he was known as one of the best number sevens of his generation. So he didn't deliver a World Cup either. So, I mean, but it did make a lot of news, the rape, you know, charges, that was all over the news here. And the fact that he supports Bolsonaro, everyone is just saying, well, of course he would, because all of the pedophiles, rapists, you know, people accused of domestic violence and things like that, they all support Bolsonaro because he's like a rape culture promoting president, as his recent comments about following a 14-year-old Venezuelan girl who he felt a spark with to her home and discovering it was just a child prostitution ring, you know? Yeah. But he just told this story on a podcast 2 weeks ago, like it was just completely normal. I mean, that's the kind of attitude he has. He feels like he can feel sexual chemistry with a 14-year-old girl. And that's why the most macho, sexist, misogynist part of the population really likes him.
Yeah, definitely. So we got a question from T. Brown. Maybe Camilla, you can come in on this one. Like, you know, following on from what we are saying about the football players and the religions, like, to what extent is Christianity like the main factor that is used to sort of keep the Bolsonaro coalition together and to keep right-wing voters together?
I don't know. Maybe Brian's better at answering that. I mean, it's just a factor in every country. It just happens to be more of a factor here. There is, you know, there is these sort of areas of the country where that's very predominant. We have even some comrades and friends here in Sao Paulo who are part of the social movements who said that they're the only, you know, they're the only people in their family who are, you know, a leftist or who do this sort of activism, that everybody else where they come from, you know, in smaller towns and rural areas are, you know, part of a church, they're part of a very conservative community. And it's very difficult to break out of that bubble. you know, within that bubble, you have, like Brian mentioned earlier, the WhatsApp chats, the sort of disinformation that gets circulated to that really often targets, you know, as we know, certain people, which is, you know, older adults, for example. And there's this sort of, you know, people clinging to like morality and trying to actually paint Lula as some sort of, well, we saw comments on our own videos. Well, I tweeted this, a little bit of a thread about this encounter that Lula had with evangelical Christians who met with him to give their official endorsement of his presidential ticket. And, you know, there was a range of these faith leaders, but it was evangelical specifically for the most part. And someone actually commented that Lula is actually an atheist, that he's not actually a Christian as he says he is. And that, you know.
Well Bolsonaro is a Catholic and he pretends to be evangelical, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's just trying to say that, you know, Lula's stance, they're trying to say that Lula's stance that he's against on a personal level, his own conviction, his own position on abortion is that he's against it, although he's repeatedly said that it's up to the legislative powers to decide what's going to happen with the issue of abortion within the country. It's not up to him as president if he is to take power once again. But they're trying to say that he actually is for abortion. So we're in a climate right now where it's very difficult to say that I'm for, generally speaking, this decision to be made by the legislature or for women to decide for themselves. You can't even come out and say that. And I would say that that, you know, in no way has affected the social movement's position in favor of Lula. But they do know that, you know, as far as campaigning goes, what this means is this entire campaign, at least on the presidential level, you know, you can't campaign too hard to the left. You do have to remember that you are pandering to, you are speaking to an audience that is largely Christian and a very large, significantly massive evangelical population. And you can't go off script. There are plenty of things that Lula might have in store, that the PT and this, you know, coalition of parties might have in store for the sort of program that they would like to roll out next year. But there's things that just can't be said because it's a very sensitive time right now. And, you know, and you don't want to piss off those, you know, last remaining voters who, you know, they don't, it's like on the one hand, the fear mongering about this, this country turning into so-called Venezuela and communism. And, you know, that goes hand in hand with like losing sight of morality as a country.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just add a few things here. First of all, it's important to know that the evangelicals only make up around 30% of Brazil's population. Brazil's 51% Catholic. And there's been a lot of, in the West, especially BBC, this kind of narrative spread that, you know, Brazil's all evangelical now, and that all of the poor evangelicals like Bolsonaro. BBC even made a documentary about this, when in fact, most poor evangelicals support Lula. Most poor people in general support Lula, you know, at a 2-to-1 ratio. It's these kind of like lower middle class evangelical Christians who are these fanatic right wingers. But the phenomenon of evangelical Christianity in Brazil, unfortunately, it goes back to the basically Cardinal Ratzinger under Pope Paul John Paul II. John Paul II decided to just purge the church of liberation theology. All of the most important social movements in Brazil have their roots in the liberation theology movement, which was one of the only parts of resistance during the military dictatorship. The military like begrudgingly allowed the Catholic Church to do this kind of organizing in these ecclesiastical based communities, these pastorals and things like that. And it was their work putting people with similar struggles together with each other on a national level that gave birth to organizations like the MST, you know, and the Central de Movimentos Populares, which was literally founded by a liberation theology priest, Frei Beto, and the other big social movements. And what happened in the 90s is they all, you know, they started excommunicating or censoring liberation theology leaders. Like Leonardo Boff was ordered by Ratzinger to be silent, to take a vow of silence for like 5 years, and he just left the church. So the Pope defunded the liberation theology movement, and this was really what the PT relied on for a lot of its political organizing. Like they worried about the politics and policy and things like that. They knew that liberation theology priests and nuns were organizing in the poor communities with the social movements. So this vacuum opened up in the favelas and in the poor rural areas. And that vacuum, that power vacuum, was filled by evangelical churches, which came in and they convinced all of these people that their wealth or their well-being, their happiness, had nothing to do with public policies. It was entirely related to their personal relationship with God. So like, if they were unemployed, it was because they weren't praying enough. And so this was a way to completely depoliticize large sectors of Brazilian society. You know, and that's why sometimes you get these bourgeois radical leftists up in Brooklyn or wherever complaining like the PT isn't doing the kind of political mobilizing work it used to do in the 80s and 90s when it started out. And really what's happened is that they weren't in a position to take over all the work that the liberation theology movement was doing, right? And so that's like one of the reasons we ended up in this situation. And I think that, you know, the U.S. obviously encouraged this. You know, I interviewed Jean-Claude Fignolet in Haiti once, who's a founder of the Spiralism movement, this kind of Marxist literary movement. He was like 70. He said in Haiti, the evangelical churches are antenna for the CIA. You know, and I feel like the big American churches down here and the Mormons and things like that, they're definitely collaborating with U.S. intel gathering. But in Brazil, you have these homegrown evangelical churches, many of which, especially in Rio de Janeiro, do money laundering for the drug trafficking gangs. And so that's the power base that Bolsonaro came out of. These extremely corrupt, you know, money laundering organizations posing as evangelical churches, but they're now like telling all of their followers that Lula is Satan, you know, that this election is a battle between God and Satan and things like that. You know, they're like the dirtiest organizations out there.
Yeah, Brian, we actually got a question about, I think this raises an interesting point. It says from Dennis Curry, said, does Washington control these evangelicals in Africa and South America? And I guess that how much of the sort of evangelical movement or churches are just sort of imports, are like have money brought in? I mean, even here in Bolivia, I see Mormon churches, for example, springing up. And I know for a fact that is built directly with money that's sent in from the Mormon church in the United States. Is that the case in Brazil? Or is it, as you said, like more homegrown sort of churches just sort of setting up little bit things?
Brazil's got some, you know, heavily Americanized evangelical churches, but it also has homegrown organizations like Universal, you know, which has colonized the United States. I mean, Universal Kingdom of God, they own a radio station in London. You know, they have churches all over the world now. And it was born in Brazil. Early on, they got a $1 million grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, when they were starting out. But it's a church that requires its followers to tithe 10% of their income to the church. So it's just incredibly rich. They now own the second biggest TV station, TV network in Brazil. They were kicked out of Angola wonderfully, you know, because Angola said they just take advantage of people who are in vulnerable situations. They exploit the poor and the vulnerable. I wish everyone would kick them out, you know, but you know, so it's I'd say it's like a mix, really, between U.S. And homegrown evangelical organizations.
Yeah. But anyway, Camilla, how, like, when sort of changing it a bit back to what we're talking about in the first part about sort of the polls, etc., you know, when you talk to people at Lula rallies or PT members, like, how confident are they feeling going into this after the first round vote? How, like, what are they saying, both sort of in interviews and perhaps when the camera's not on?
Well, you know, they're saying that this is their opportunity, their one and only chance in the next 4 years to take their country back. It's about the restoration of democracy. It's about taking back the institutions and about fixing everything that's been broken deliberately, strategically, systematically over these last 6 years in the country. And so the situation is very dire. It is very urgent, as the saying says, you know, Brazil urgente, Lula presidente, because this is like 6 years in the making. People are extremely nervous. They're on the edge of their seats. I would say there is some optimism because of the polls that we've seen for the last several months and the polls that are coming out right now that give Lula that advantage. But overall, I think people are a little bit, you know, shaken by what they witnessed on October 2nd, by, you know, how well Bolsonaro performed. And they are fearful of the sort of tactics that we might see in the coming hours and on election day itself. You know, there are a lot of different factors that could play out. One of the things that I think Ryan was mentioning to me, or maybe it was another friend, I've been talking to a lot of people today, was that perhaps it was another PT friend who was saying that, you know, that what will happen once again, as on election day, is of course we're going to see the early votes come in, and those, you know, first votes are going to be favorable to Bolsonaro because those are the areas, the regions of the country that get counted first. And that can easily be manipulated. It has been in other countries, of course, in Bolivia, you know, that people get ahead of the count and they start, you know, making declarations based on very small amounts of preliminary data or what have you. Also, you know, there's, like Brian did mention, that we're going to be going out to Paulista Avenue for this grand celebration on Sunday night, and the social movements and the unions are preparing to do so. But also Bolsonaro's people would like to be doing that because it's supposed to be the winners of this election that are supposed to be allowed to take Paulista Avenue. So, you know, that there's concern about, you know, some of the different things that could play out, how these images could be reproduced and manipulated in the media to make, you know, make people believe that the result is something that it's not. So I think people are very watchful, and, you know, they're doing everything they can, like we described in the beginning, the flyering, the campaigning, the stickering at these, you know, major transportation points around the major cities is very important. The campaign goes technically until Saturday night, tomorrow night. And, you know, there's a huge push to get out the vote because they know they can't leave it up to chance. And as we've seen in Bolivia and in other countries, it's very important to also have the widest margin of victory possible in order for it to not be disputed in the different ways that we've heard that Bolsonaro may attempt to dispute the result.
Exactly. Like, I think the plan all along has been for Bolsonaro to come within 3 points. You know, if he comes within 3 points, he can contest the election. Easily. I mean, if he loses by 5 or 6 points, it gets a lot harder.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, I know you guys got a busy agenda. I don't want to keep you too long. So before we closed, I think just wanted to know two things quickly. Is first, obviously, the elections are on Sunday, but when, what sort of time do you think we can expect to know, you know, which way this has gone? And two, if Lula wins, if Lula wins, what's gonna happen? Like, are people gonna be like partying in the streets? Is there gonna be like people going around on motorbikes honking their horn? Like, what do you think is gonna be like their immediate reaction?
Well, the polls will be closing at 5 p.m. Brazil time across the country, and Lula is scheduled to speak at the Intercontinental Hotel here in downtown Sao Paulo at 8:30 p.m. That's obviously just tentative, but we'll be there listening for his remarks. They pushed that back from the first round, which was 7 p.m., because it's very important to get a clear picture of what's going on before he says anything, of course. The social movements, for example, the landless workers movement, which is, you know, the most important movement that we follow here in Brazil, they'll be, you know, gathering to see the vote count on screens, and wait for those results together and position themselves to go out to Paulista Avenue to celebrate. And those sorts of things will be happening all around the country as well. One thing we didn't talk about as much was actually that Brian used to live here and be based here in Sao Paulo. He's lived in several places of Brazil, and now he's in the Northeast in the state of Pernambuco, the capital of Recife. And that's a PT stronghold. Things look a little different there. Maybe tell us a little bit about how things are in Recife. And I don't know if you talked about like some of the electoral victories that were really important in the first round for the social movement.
Okay, yeah. First of all, like, let me just say, the results should be in by 9 p.m. Brazil has a very quick tallying process. It's not like the U.S. where 20 years later, people still don't know if George Bush really won the election. There's a lot of, people worried that there are going to be acts of terrorism and violence if Lula wins. Bolsonaro has called out to his followers, his armed followers, to surround the polling stations until the tallying is done. Obviously, that's not going to happen. He doesn't have enough followers to do that in every polling station, but it's going to happen in some, especially in the Midwest, and in the areas of regions that are the most evangelical and militia controlled on the west side of Rio, in a place like that. There could be, I hope there isn't any, but I have a strong feeling that there's going to be some, gunfights, murders and things going on, unfortunately, if Lula wins. Hopefully none. To get to the other point, the Northeast is the, if Lula wins, which will probably happen, it's because of the Northeast. The Northeast historically is the poorest region of Brazil. It has about 50 million residents, and they voted 2-1 for Haddad over Bolsonaro in 2018. And they're currently 67-30% in favor of Lula against Bolsonaro. If it was up to the other regions, Lula probably wouldn't even win the election. So in Recife, where I live now, it's a city of about 4 million people. It's actually from the state Lula was born in, Pernambuco. And even in the richest neighborhoods of the city, you see as many flags in the luxury apartment building balconies for Lula as you do for Bolsonaro. And I can hear the protest going by outside. That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. It literally sounds like the rally we were in earlier is going by outside right now.
So okay. Well, I won't keep you then. There is a couple of really good questions that came up in the live chat. And I think we're going to deal with them on Sunday. So I want to tell everyone who's watching and listening that on Sunday, I think with Camilla, we're going to go live again as the results come in, just for sort of immediate reactions. She's going to try and grab who she can that's going past, just to inform then. So we've got a good question from Evco about US links to both Bolsonaro and Lula, and another question about from the lie that led to War 1951 about the post Lula future and relations with Latin America. But we are going to deal with those questions on Sunday, because as you might be able to hear, there's the rally going on outside just where Camille and Brian are. So thank you so much to both of you. I hope to speak again soon once we've got some results as well. Cheers, guys.
Thanks so much, Ollie.
Take it easy. Cheers. Thanks for having me, guys. Both of you. I'm a big fan of you guys. You're one of my favorite media outlets. So.
Well, we're a big fan of you, obviously. So. But... yeah, to everyone watching, see you on Sunday. We're going to be coming in with the results on Sunday evening. So see you then. Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thanks a lot.